Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to Building Sustainability Podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey Hart, aka Jeffrey the Natural Builder. Building Sustainability consists of conversations with designers, builders, makers, dreamers, and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things.
Hello, and welcome to episode 61 of the Building Sustainability Podcast. I have been a bit quiet here at Building Sustainability HQ for a couple of reasons. Firstly, and fittingly with today's episode, I have been working at the Design Museum, been clay plastering their new exhibition, Waste Age. Let me read you a little blurb about the Waste Age exhibition. A new generation of designers is rethinking our relationship to everyday things, from fashion to food, electronics to construction, even packaging, finding the lost value in our trash and imagining a future of clean materials and circular economy that could point the way out of the waste age. Great, that's fitting, isn't it? So we were asked to clay plaster the exhibition stands, and I mean, it felt really good, given the opportunity to put clay in front of so many people, especially considering the exhibition topic. The plasters that Rebecca Reed, who I worked with on this project, she designed two different plasters using waste materials from the brick-making industry, one using ash from a wood-fired brick kiln, and the other chalk, which is dug up as part of the search for the right kind of clay. So yeah, both byproducts of an industry that we used to create, you know, fine finishes that are really quite beautiful to look at. And not to mention, really a great thing to have in a museum because they control the climate and the heat. So yeah, really quite a wonderful thing to be asked to put that clay in the design museum. And for me, the original reason I actually said yes to the project was that the design museum was a really big, important point in my life. When I was studying for my A-level in design technology, they had an exhibition about chairs that I went to see while we were doing a chair project. And it was hugely influential. So yeah, I was thrilled to be asked to be part of that. So the project was hectic, to say the least. We had 8 days of, well, we were doing very well if it wasn't a 12-hour day. So, yeah, 8 long days of hard work. And really, I want to thank my team, first and foremost. Rebecca Reed, of course, who I've mentioned many times on this podcast. She designed these fantastic plasters and then led the plastering team. And 3 of just the best clay plasterers I could think of. So that was Anna Castillo-Villa, Jamie Engel, and Becky Little, all worked absolutely tirelessly And with such high quality finishes, I'm so pleased with everything they did. And those names you probably will recognise as previous guests on the podcast. So really, it did feel like I was sort of pulling together my superhero team. I don't really know superhero movies, but I think that's what's happening these days. So yeah, that was brilliant and exhausting. So then I managed to squeeze in a really quick earth floor job, laying some earth floor in a kitchen of a brand new house on a new housing development by one of the big volume house builders. So feels pretty good to be getting a bit of mud into one of those buildings. And then I popped off and went and cycled as a quick escape, just a week of cycling around the Isle of Wight and the South Coast. And oh, what a perfect reset to get out into the bivy bag, watch the sunrise and the sunset every day. It really is the way to de-stress after a pretty hectic time. So yes, that's why I haven't done any podcasts recently. Thank you very much for your patience. I do very much appreciate it. I am back now. I've got a month booked off where I am just going to be focusing on finishing my house, trying to get in and warm before it gets too cold to live in the caravan I'm in. But yeah, we've got some great guests for the podcast coming up, and I very much can't wait to share them with you. Before this episode, though, just want to say a very quick and hugely heartfelt thank you to Claire Henderson, to Sarah Krishna, and to Anna Kostreva. Apologies if I've pronounced any of those names wrong. They are new supporters on the Building Sustainability Patreon. And really, thank you to everyone that supports. There's a fair number of you now, and it really does... it makes this podcast be able to continue. So thank you. I think that's it. I should let you get on and listen to Duncan Baker Brown. Enjoy the episode. I will be back at the end.
I'm a practicing architect. I'm also an author. I wrote a book called The Reuse Atlas, subtitled A Designer's Guide Towards a Circular Economy. I've sort of taught and researched around sustainable design since 1994. So I've mixed research, practice, and teaching. I also describe myself as an environmental activist within the industry, the construction sector, and architecture.
Okay, well, I wanted to start with something I heard on a video that you did, which was the origins of the term waste.
Well, at the University of Brighton, I've been fortunate enough to work with people that know a lot more than I do about waste. So Dr. Ryan Woodard at the University of Brighton, he says that the idea, the sort of concept of waste, was sort of invented in about 1861 in the UK, in England. And it was at that point that we were so, as a nation, became wealthy on the plunder from our Commonwealth, from our empire, because obviously we were just plundering the planet at the time, whether that was resources or people or whatever, that and we weren't paying for it, that we were able to start throwing stuff away. So it was with the brick industry as well. So bricks had always been made out of the minimal amount of raw material and most amount of waste material. And of course, dustmen get their name because that was literally the only thing that was being thrown away, and even dust could be collected to be part of the process of making bricks. So in the second half of the 19th century, we were so wealthy as a nation that we could actually just make buildings out of 100% raw materials and throw stuff away. And it was at that point that it became common practice. But only with the sort of elite, wealthy nations. and there weren't that many then. So yeah, that's supposedly the origin of it.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's not fantastic. It's awful, but it's
well, it sort of shows that we knew what to do before that, and before 1861 sort of thing. Buildings of. And we talk about the built environment because it's the major investment of humans to create it. It's what the major amount of effort we do is to construct shelters to live in. And up until basically the 20th century, our buildings were reusable. And so it's only in the 20th century that brick walls aren't easy to deconstruct. Because we use cement-based mortars now, and we used to use lime-based mortars. So actually, we use lime-based mortars all the time, because that means that if you invest in a material like brick, which has got a high carbon footprint, you can use it again and again and again, as opposed to using it just for 60 years, or in some cases only 20 years, before it becomes rubble.
Yeah. I think a lot of what we're going to talk about today is circular economy. Circular economy is maybe a term that people have heard a lot, but maybe don't sort of fully have a grasp of. Can you give an
example?
Yeah,
of course. I mean, I start by saying the way we exist at the moment is not like a circular economy. We exist as a linear economy. So, and we're pretty much the only system in the natural world that does this. So we take materials, we mine and harvest materials, we process them into things, and then we use them for moments, and then we throw them away. So wherever humans have been or are, there is a pile of waste. If you think about the rest of the planet, waste from one ecosystem is food and a resource for another system. So we're literally the only linear system on the planet that doesn't get sorted out and turned into a circular system. A circular economy is a world of closed-loop systems, which is exactly what the natural world is. It's a closed-loop system. There's no waste in the natural world. Everything's used. And so broadly speaking, what we're talking about doing is transforming at a systemic level the way that humans exist on the planet, to exist as the rest of the planet does, rather than as a totally different way of existing, which is is at the end of the day suicidal for us, because the planet is finite, the resources are finite, and despite people shooting off into space looking to colonize Mars or whatever, from my point of view, we've got to sort it out down here and look at how we can turn those linear systems into circular ones. And the reason it's so impactful and important in the construction sector for me, and I just think it is anyway, is because the construction sector consumes 50% of all raw materials mined and harvested every year. And we're up to about 100 billion tons of resources annually that are mined and harvested. And so 50 billion tons a year is expended on the built environment. And that, of course, includes roads and dams and infrastructure, but the stuff of cities, the stuff that the Anthropocene, the human made layer of stuff that's we produce. And at the moment, we use a lot of it for literally moments and then throw it away and then mine for more new resources, process it, use it for a bit, throw it away. And we don't need to exist like that. I've been saying a lot lately that what would happen if we just closed down conventional mines? I mean, nobody wants to work in a mine. They're the most horrible places for humans to be, whether they're open cast or underground. And they are one of the main reasons for the loss of natural habitat. It's the destruction of the natural habitat for resources, whether those resources are beef or copper or whatever. So it's the resources that humans consume. But what we're not doing very much of is actually reusing these resources. There's apparently more copper above ground than below ground.
Right.
So with that in mind, we'll use the stuff that's above ground then. Look at it. So yeah. I came up with this phrase, mine the Anthropocene. So close down conventional mines and mine the Anthropocene. Look at ways of reusing the stuff that's been previously produced by humans, been processed. It's already got the carbon emissions, the carbon footprint, and the what people don't talk about so much now, which is the ecological footprint of something. You know, it's not just carbon. It's the combined negative impact that constructing a building or a city has on the rest of the planet. All the resources, water, food, energy, materials that go into designing and creating a thing, whether it's a pen or a city. That's what we need to be considering. And if we can reuse stuff that's already been processed, we will basically give nature a break. You know, we will back off from it for a bit. And we've seen a bit, with the first lockdown in COVID, we saw the benefits of just giving nature a break. Yeah. That's all we need to do at one level. If we back off a bit, let it sort itself out. There might be cases where we need to advance this because we've gone past the tipping point. So we need to do some very well-informed rewilding rather than just planting trees, as people are saying at the moment. We've got to do it in a bit more of an informed way. Mm-hmm. But we've got that opportunity if we start not demolishing like we demolish around the world, not demolishing buildings, but adapting them and reusing them. And so that's what I'm passionate about, because to do it well and successfully, like I said earlier, you need to change at sort of systemic level. So, you know, people need the sort of supply chain for the construction industry needs to work in a totally different way. It needs to be able to deal with secondhand materials. It needs to be able to be in a world where we deconstruct redundant bits of the built environment rather than demolish it. You outlaw demolition. We don't do demolition anymore. We deconstruct carefully so you can reuse elements. And I'm lucky enough to be working with people who deconstruct the sort of buildings you'd think from the 20th century or even the 21st century. You'd think these are buildings that you cannot deconstruct. They have to be demolished because they have been for the last 75 years. But there's most buildings can be deconstructed one way or another. And at the moment, we're still in the world where, especially in our rich financial districts, where you've got the massive international financial institutions who are wanting to show off their wealth and nowness by, having that, making sure that their 30-story towers are completely up to date in terms of design fashion. So these buildings that, they're only lasting 20 years, not because we're building in such a bad way that they only last 20 years. They're lasting 20 years because they've come out of fashion. And so a typical tall building in a financial district will, first thing that happens with them, by the way, is that a lot of them have a temporary interior to attract tenants. Then a tenant will say, I'll have 5 floors or 10 floors or whatever. And the first thing they do is they want to put their own identity on the floor. So that temporary interior, which might only be 3 months old, is torn out of the inside of the tower. So that gets thrown away. And then they mark the building with their identity, their brand. And then 7 years later, that brand's tired or whatever. So they redo it. Fast forward to 20 years and the whole tower's tired, in inverted commas, and down it comes. So yeah, that's where a lot of resources are consumed, in these buildings that have to sort of constantly be maintained just for the sake of appearing to be of now. And there's a lot of, if you just dealt with that part of the market first of all, you're going to reduce a lot of consumption of stuff. And I'm really happy to say that some people are doing it. I mean, British Land and Lendlease have just refurbished a project in the City of London, Number One Triton Square. It's a building that's only 19 years old, and instead of demolishing it, they, with the glass facade, they realised that because the building was so young, they could deconstruct the facade, clean it up, upgrade the mullions for the glass, and put it back on the building, and have a guarantee for that thing. Because this is what concerns a lot of people. If you've got secondhand stuff, how do you know the performance of it? Where do you get guarantees of performance? And of course, when you're talking about a building that's only 19 years old, the supply chain's still there. So the company that supplied the facade in the first place still exists. So they only had to contact that company and then say, can we deconstruct this thing, clean it up and paint it back up where it was, improved energy rating, insulation rating, and will you give it an insurance and guarantees, which is about nine what we need to do. And they said yes. So, you know, in a way, so for me, that's an easy thing to do. There are, and in the case of this building, it was a way of saving tens of thousands of tons of concrete because the building didn't get demolished. Steel, reuse steel, and reuse glass. So, yeah, the amount of resources that were not consumed to allow that to happen. But that, in a way, that's a sort of, you know, it's a case study, an exemplar project that needs to now impact on financial districts around the world. Mm-hmm. And, of course, these financial districts are currently underused because of COVID. So people are asking questions about them anyway. But what we don't want is the sort of mass demolition of these buildings to, you know, replace them with housing or whatever. They need to be converted, adapted into whatever's required moving forward post-COVID. But that's going to need a lot of design time, design and creative design thinking. So that's, you know, I often do a talk which is entitled Designers Can Save the World, because I think we need to design the systems, the software, the emerging materials to replace plastics or to somehow have plastics with an end of life strategy that isn't the oceans. This sort of stuff needs to be designed. And it's really exciting at the moment because there's a lot of people having a good go at this. So whether it's people tackling the deconstruction of buildings that normally get demolished, or people who a company called Biome, who are doing a lot of research and now developing materials made out of mycelium. Mm-hmm. So, and this is organic fungi roots, mushroom roots, that create stuff material that you can use as an organic option to plastic packaging, or in the case with Biome's product, they're about to market insulation for buildings. So that's amazing, because this material, according to their calculations, it's got as good insulating value as the most high performance plastic materials out there. So that's wow, that's great. And by the way, it's got a far superior fire rating, because obviously plastics burn in fire, as we all know, and this stuff doesn't. But the great news is also it performs well. But if you put it in the ground, 3 months later, it's gone. So as opposed to being part of the Anthropocene like plastic waste is. So, and one day, I mean, one day we're going to have this sort of mycelium mix that when it grows, it consumes the food stock for it is plastic. So one day we could even have old plastic insulation being the food stock source for organic insulation. I mean, what an amazing thing. So I'm really heartened with these sorts of ideas. And But what we've really got to work on is convincing the world of architecture that we've got to sort of retrofit and adapt the existing built environment rather than demolish and start again. Mm-hmm. And it needs a different sensibility, a sort of modesty, I think, you know, working with buildings that have been designed by other people. You know, you've got to put away your I'm the architect sort of ego.
Yeah.
And, you know, the big challenge is without having an ego, you've got to adapt that building so it's climate resilient, low carbon, healthy and habitable for humans that have got to deal with what will probably be a 2-2.5 degree temperature rise moving forward. And that's assuming we do something about it.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, wow, there's a lot to get into there. I think it's interesting that I hadn't considered that with the buildings being sort of renovated or, you know, redressed. I mean, it's very comparable to sort of fast fashion
Yeah, exactly.
We're getting more and more sort of cycles that we can create a new look for, and they become faster and faster.
Well, I'm working with a consultancy called Rota Deconstruction, based in Brussels, and they're part of the team deconstructing some so-called redundant, in inverted commas, buildings in the World Trade Center. And so they're deconstructing it, and they've got a digital platform, so you can buy this stuff via the digital platform, and they've got the warehouses and yards to store the material as well. I've been to see it. So, you know, this stuff is happening. I'm also working on a EU Interreg funded project with them, which is identifying across six Northern European countries, 1,500 suppliers who are dealing with the deconstruction of buildings, but crucially also the introduction of that material into the supply chain. So, you know, this stuff is happening. Yeah, so when that's published, that is an amazing resource. If you want to check it out online, it's called F for Freddy, CRBE, FCRBE, Interreg FCRBE. Have a look at that, because they've already published some documents online, which in effect are things like a guideline to spotting the sort of the materials and systems that are deconstructible rather than recyclable. So yeah. This is the whole difference, obviously, between reuse and recycling. Reuse is a lot more of a bigger deal. So, I think these things are happening. It just needs to be more commonplace. And we need the legislation on board to encourage people to work with existing environments and adapt them rather than clear, fell and demolish. Because, you know, at the moment, we're in a world in the UK where VAT at 20% is applied to retrofit projects. So if you've got £300 or £3 million to spend on retrofitting a building, a residential building, you'll be giving 20% of that to the Chancellor of the Exchequer. If you demolish the building and build from new, you don't have to pay VAT at all.
Oh, wow.
So we're
that's
actively
ridiculous.
Encouraging. And people sort of don't realise that, but that's a huge, huge barrier to retrofit. You know, big developers would be reusing and adapting existing buildings for new housing, in inverted commas, housing schemes, if the tax laws were encouraging retrofit, but they don't at the moment. And there are campaigns. The Architects Journal has its Retro First campaign. As a campaign to, there was a sort of you could sign up on a government website, sort of to get central government, Parliament talking about the VAT issue, but they haven't. So it's the campaigns aren't that successful yet, but obviously if you think about what Insulate Britain is all about, it's, you know, Insulate Britain are a big pain in the neck for a lot of people at the moment, because obviously they're stopping us traveling around the motorways. But yeah, this is how important the retrofitting of our housing and our built environment is. And it's sort of been ignored by central government at the moment. Maybe they're doing something behind the scenes at the moment that I don't know anything about. But at the moment, the tax laws discourage it. And when there are incentives, whatever Green Deal incentives that the government has, they have it open for like 4 months and close again. It's just like, there needs to be, you know, a minister for retrofitting, because we've got 20, you know, houses being built today will need retrofitting. And we don't have the building regulation standards to apply, because building regulations aren't anywhere near the sort of carbon descent plan that's required to meet net zero targets.
Yeah.
And what's becoming apparent, on the good side, good news actually, is there's a lot of organisations in the UK construction sector who have in effect got an agreed consensus on a whole life carbon descent plan. So what I'm talking about is the sort of carbon footprint of the materials and that go into making a building, and then the operational carbon, i.e. the energy costs, heating and energy costs of a building during its life, but also the cost of throwing it away or not at the end of its life. So that whole life, when you add those things together, it's sort of whole life carbon. And there's a sort of carbon descent plan that the London Energy what's it called, London Energy Transformation Initiative, LETI. They brought out a document, their Climate Emergency Design Guide, about 2 years ago, which was fascinating because there's 1,000 people who had inputted into that document. And it's a very clear guide on what the embodied and operational carbon value figures for different buildings in different sectors should be to meet net zero targets. So we've got that, but building regulations haven't bought into it. So it's only a guide that you can implement or not. But it makes it very clear that the embodied carbon factor is a big, big deal, becoming a bigger deal because operational energy, the consumption of, is one, getting cleaner, but the source is getting cleaner, but also the use is dropping a little bit. So it's the embodied carbon in the making of the thing and the throwing away of the thing. It's a big, big deal. Yeah. But it's good news that we got consensus in the industry of what to do, but we don't have the central government legislation, tax initiatives and incentives to support it. And that's the big ask at the moment. We need that because if you think about what Insulate Britain are protesting about at the moment, they want 20 or 29 million homes in this country to be retrofitted within 4 or 5 years. Well, that's sort of an impossible ask, but it's what we need to do to, if we're going to avoid the mass temperature change due to the climate and ecological emergencies. So They're only taking the IPCC data and saying, well, that, if you think about the built environment, this is what we need to do. So maybe there's a longer time we'll take to do the retrofit, but it needs it that we, the government, a central government needs to have a minister in charge of retrofit, a retrofit ministry. We got the retrofit academy. We need to be teaching the skills. But the bottom line is, from the point of view of the government, it's a huge employment opportunity. You could think of the retrofitting of our built environment as a national infrastructure project, but it's rolled out across the whole of the country. And it's going to create jobs and training and jobs and money, people's wages. But also the bottom line is you're going to have climate resilient, comfortable, low carbon built environment for people to live in. And at the moment, you've got thousands of people suffering from, well, millions of people suffering from fuel poverty every year, and thousands of people dying every year from being too cold, and in some cases in our summers too hot. So something's got to happen, but we're talking about something that might cost 500 or 600 billion pounds to do, which actually on the scale of a country like the UK is not a huge amount of money, especially if the benefit is going to be across the whole country in terms of employment, skills, blah blah blah. And it just makes something like HS2 look even more ridiculous than it is. Wow, yeah, just yes. To shave 20 minutes off your commute time, which we don't need to bother about anymore anyway. It's like 3.5 HS2s.
Yeah. And that's not even considering the cost of, the rising cost of dealing with climate change. That's only going to get more and more expensive.
The more we delay it, the worse it's going to be. So yeah. At the moment, they're still talking about 1.5 degrees. If we act now, I don't think we can act quickly enough. I think that's one thing that Insulate Britain are pointing out, really. We can't act quick enough. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be worse than that. And therefore, what we have to do to our built environment to make it comfortable to live in is even more than we might have had to do 20 years ago when we knew about it, 30 years ago when we knew about it. And if you dig out really old press cuttings from 1918, you can see post First World War we knew about it as well. So it's interesting the degrees of climate denial, climate emergency denial that we have always, or for a long time, been in, and we still are. I think as a community of humans around the world, there's a large percentage of people who really are deniers of all of this. There's a lot of good things going on. I mean, I sound a bit gloomy, but there are good things going on in all parts of society. Even in the financial sector, there's good, encouraging things going on. But the bottom line is, you and I at the moment, before COP26, we don't know if it's going to be a success or not, because at the moment, the sounds are people saying they're not even going to turn up. You talk about the Prime Minister of Australia, Scott Morrison, thinking about not turning up and most of his country was scorched. Well, most of the green part of his country, which wasn't scorched before, is scorched now. And we may be coming, you know. And the United States, where there's a mass evacuation from California because it's becoming uninhabitable, where 1 in 8 trees in California is dead now because it's been burnt, they're still thinking maybe they won't commit behind their president's ambitious carbon, you know, net zero targets. It's I can't believe it. You know, I can't believe we're dithering over it.
Yeah. Yes. Well, let's maybe let's look at some positives and see what is happening.
Yeah.
I'm keen to show that it's not all doom and gloom.
Well, you can edit that last bit out if you want.
No, that's fine. I think, you know, a dose of realism is definitely needed. I guess where do I want to start? Well, let's maybe start with buildings as material stores.
Yes, that's an idea I referred to earlier indirectly. It's this idea that at the end of a building's first useful life, it isn't just thrown away, it is seen as an asset. And it's a phrase that's being used a lot by people in the world of the circular economy. And it's the way we used to design our buildings up until the early part of the 20th century, where we started sticking them together with cement mortar and glues and the expanded foam that you get to create airtight buildings and just to stick windows into walls sometimes. But that concept is great as a concept, the idea that at the end of life of a building, you can unpack it and in effect sell it off as assets. That's got to be attractive to the financial sector, for example, because at the moment with their 20, 25 year lifespan for one of their tall towers, they're assuming at the end of its life, they have to throw it away. So that's a deficit. So I do know, for example, that the ABN AMRO Bank, which is the National Bank of the Netherlands, because I spoke to one of their employees who was the client for their Circle Pavilion in Amsterdam. And this is a building. It's about 18 million euros of building, which was designed to circular economy principles. So they collected employees' jeans and reprocessed them into denim insulation. The building's basically bolted together so it can be unbolted. The materials that constitute the building are from sustainable sources. Energy's closed-loop system, water's closed-loop system, the food that they procure is a closed-loop system. Great. And Petron van Heel, who was the client, he said that he said to me when he was on site, showing me my students around, he said, "The ABN AMRO Bank, we're a financial bank. We have assets of investments in buildings around the world to the tune of 600 billion euros, but we're now a materials bank as well." So you know, you can see how it's attractive to the corporate world. That's not necessarily a good thing, but the corporate world has got the biggest consumers in the world, got the biggest carbon footprint in the world, or ecological footprint. So I'm quite happy if they want to, for me, it might be a slightly short-termism, but I'm happy if they see their buildings as material banks, because within 20, 25 years now, if that's how they're constructing their buildings, then they will not need the natural resources that they need now to construct more towers, because they'll be making them out the assets of other towers. So I think it's quite an attractive idea that the corporate world takes this on board as well. However, there are other challenges. So before I talk about those challenges, actually, it's this idea of buildings as a material store. I think if you think of your existing built environment like that as well, again, it's a sort of different way of thinking about the building, and therefore it might encourage you to deconstruct your building rather than demolish it, because you see it as an asset of stuff. And what's interesting now is you've got companies mapping these assets, so which obviously mainly in cities. And so you've got companies like Metabolic, who they do these three-dimensional resource maps of cities. They do these maps of the flows of stuff, and cities are obviously where stuff all comes and congregates, but at the moment it tends to flow in and out. And so they're mapping water, food, energy, but also the stuff of the built environment. And they do these lovely 3D maps that show the intensity of resources in different parts of, say, a city like Amsterdam. So they've mapped the whole city. And so it means that if you're if you've got a building site in Amsterdam, you can, with their data, you can see the potential for the resources on that site for reuse or recycling. So it gives you a sort of material map to work with.
Excellent.
And I know they're doing these maps. I know the University of Exeter and Bradford have done a project where they've mapped the building types and materials that go into these building types for the whole of Bradford. And I know that, you know, we very soon there'll be maps of most cities, which is a resource that we can all use in the world of the built environment, because it's telling us the materials we can play with for reuse. And by the way, I'm not advocating whole-scale deconstruction of buildings. I'm talking about adapting buildings as well. So, you know, when you adapt them, you don't have to just smash a bit down and build an extension. You're sort of, again, unpacking it and maybe using that material to help build the extension, for example. So it works at different scales.
You've got some buildings going on in Brighton using that principle. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we work across the southeast of England, and we borrowed an idea that was, from my point of view, invented by a practice called Superuse. They came up with this harvest map idea. So it's literally using Google Earth, you and other platforms, you map what's on site in terms of resources. So that might include human resources and networks, digital and social and what have you. But also primarily, as I've been talking about, the sort of materials that are on site. And then they do these concentric circles out from the development site of, say, 1 kilometre, 5 kilometres, 10 kilometres, looking at the stuff nearby. And we do our own version of that. But before I tell you about that, Superuse would generate projects out of that practice. So they wouldn't have a project, an architectural project, but they'd know that there was a pile of wind turbine blades that were damaged, never used. They were just a bit buckled. They were going to go to landfill, and they think, right, what can we do with that pile of resources? So that's an opposite way around to normally you'd say, right, I need a theatre. Now let's find the material for the theatre. Well, you might, you know, large wind turbine blades might not be able to make a theatre. So you have to think about how they could be used. And they've used them for children's playgrounds. I mean, some of the parts of the section through the blades is so big that they can make a cafe out of a bit of it. And then the smaller bits are bits for the kids to climb on and stuff. But they've done a number of playgrounds just from that resource of material. So they've stopped, diverted it from landfill. But there's something that we do as well. And the first time we did it was in the year 2000, where we did a resource map for a project in Romney Marsh, which is rural. It's near Rye, and it was for the Kent Wildlife Trust. And we designed and constructed this building only using locally sourced material. So just north of the site, they were growing wheat and barley, so we got straw. South of the site was Dungeness, which is the largest shingle escarpment in the world, so we got shingle. And we were able to use local timber, etc. So we designed and constructed this building just using material from within 10-mile radius. And then we've done that with numerous buildings, because in the southeast we've got a lot of woodland, a lot of managed woodland, coppice woodland, sweet chestnut, for example, which has been around since the Romans, have first brought it over because it's so durable. And so you've got this amazing resource in East and West Sussex, and it actually goes around all of London, these woodlands that have only been around because they are actually the source of material for whatever industrial age you were talking about. So from the Romans through to the Iron Age in the Middle Ages, etc. And recently, in the last 30 years, a colleague of mine, Nigel Braden, proved with the BRE that quick-grain sweet chestnut from coppices, which is only tends to be 20 or 25 years old before it's cut back, is more durable than 300-year-old oak. So sort of leave the oak trees alone, let them support 1,000 species or whatever they do when they're healthy, which is they do a lot for us, so don't chop the oak trees down. But rework these working woodlands that historically have produced charcoal and fence posts, and now actually this material is so good, and with a bit of modern engineering you can create very robust timber cladding. We can also use turn it into glue laminated structures, columns and beams, etc. So the most amazing thing, though, is if you rework these woodlands, and after the late 80s, they were the market for them fell away, so they weren't worked. If you work them, i.e. you cut down the poles every 25 years, you get a greater level of biodiversity than if you leave them alone, because they're human-constructed environments, but they can support a biodiverse environment. So we've got a lot of this sort of material around. We've got a lot of chalk because we're on the downs, which is an amazing material to work with. So if we, with my practice, Baker Brown, if we're working on a project, we look at what's on site. In some cases, we've got a project at the moment where the original house was burnt down. So we've got burned bricks, we've got burnt block work. We can use that material as aggregates for new tiles, new floor finishes. But we've got a lot of chalk as well. So that chalk, we can actually burn some of it, which obviously creates a carbon footprint. But we can burn some of it to create quicklime, which is traditionally what was done on the South Downs with chalk. And we can create mortar, lime-based mortar for our new house. We can also create lovely plasters. We've got a white clay from nearby in Plumpton, which we're using for plaster inside, a clay plaster. So these are materials that are just all around the site. They're by using the brickwork and the blockwork that's damaged on site, we're avoiding that stuff being sent off for incineration. We're using it as aggregates, so we're locking it on site. But we're at the moment, unfortunately, in the southeast and beyond, actually, there's ash dieback. So we've got we're busy at the moment chasing lorries that are stacked up with dead or dying or diseased anyway, ash trees. And we're using that material for structure and joinery for our projects as well. And in some cases, we've got a project which is a permanent pavilion for Glyndebourne Opera House. There we did a resource map, which included identifying food waste on site. So luckily, because we do research as well as practice, sometimes the research really does inform the practice. And so a few years ago, we worked on an Interreg EU-funded project, which asked us to locate waste streams and to turn those waste streams into products for the construction sector. And one thing we did is we found there's a lot of construction waste, masonry and what have you, but we found a restaurant in Brighton that threw away 55,000 oyster shells a year. And that's, we collected those oyster shells and we burnt some of them to create quicklime and added and crunched up the other oyster shells to make the aggregates, mixed them with the quicklime and some water, and you've got concrete at the end of the day made from 100% oyster shells. Now, I didn't know that off the top of my head. We worked with a genius guy called Ben Bosons from Local Work Studio, but he's interesting because he's a graduate of the RCA as a ceramicist, but then went and worked in the Belgian brick industry for hand-thrown bricks, and then became an expert on traditional construction technologies. And that whole seashell lime mortar thing is something the Romans discovered. So I'm telling you that because it requires that sort of research and reflection on the way that we used to exist. How did we do it before we could just burn huge quantities of fossil fuels to get whatever we wanted? We need that reflection. And that's allowed us, we made these tiles out of 100% oyster shell waste. We also found duvets, by the way, for insulation, because in Brighton we've got two universities with students, obviously, and we've got lots of hotels. And so at the moment it's easier to buy a duvet than it is to clean one. So that's a huge bulky waste problem, and actually it's duvets have a TOG value, which is in effect their insulation value. So we're able to test these products because we did something in 2014, by the way. We built this two-story building just out of waste material, and it's called the Waste House, even though it's not a house. It's actually a two-story teaching facility on campus at University of Brighton. And it was built by students in just a year. But the reason we did that is to prove that the sort of waste coming off construction sites was valuable. And at the time, for every five houses we were building in the UK, one house worth of waste was going to incineration or landfill. So it's 20% of everything arriving on a building site was being thrown away. So initially we said, right, that stuff being thrown away, we will prove that you can design a building to Passive House standards, get students to build it as a sort of learning experience. We had design students and construction students together with their staff, their teachers, and an amazing site agent. And we also partnered with Freegal UK. So Freegal is an online platform for swapping stuff. So we had the amazing Kat Fletcher of Freegal who sourced material for us. And initially we were just using construction material. But then Kat said, why not raise awareness of the stuff people throw away on a day-to-day basis? And this was before Blue Planet 2, David Attenborough's Blue Planet 2, and people realizing that our oceans were full of plastic. So we started capturing stuff like 20,000 toothbrushes. And we put those toothbrushes into the fabric of the building. We had 4,000 DVDs, 4,000 VHS videos from the late 80s and 90s. These things are still around us. We don't use them anymore, but they're still around. Yeah, they're part of the Anthropocene. So the building went from, look, we can design to Passive House standards with kids building it using waste construction waste, to we've created this vessel containing products without an end-of-life strategy. And on a campus that was, you know, a number of the courses on campus were around design, product design, architecture, interiors, whatever. It's a sort of a lesson for students to learn to, when they're designing things, think of the end of life strategy. And those toothbrushes, for example, they were made from a fossil fuel that took millions of years to process. They then took moments to be processed into plastic, into toothbrushes. Then they're put on an aeroplane, flown from New York to Gatwick in London, and then sent to incineration. That is the life cycle of that product, which is, you know, obviously very unintelligent. So that we are learning from that waste house, and we've been able to do these research projects. It's attracted other funding for the research projects like the oyster shell tiles, the duvet insulation, and also current project, which we're just finishing up on, which is the one with Rota, where they're identifying the suppliers, work across, you know, 1,500 suppliers working on construction material reuse. And our role within that project was to do a summer school called the School of Reconstruction, which we had to do the digital version of it this summer. Last year, we were meant to be doing the physical version, where we're getting students from across Europe to come and spend 2 weeks in Brighton and to sort of reassess the value of deconstructive material in the construction, from the construction sector. And what was amazing, we partnered with Brighton Hove City Council, and they were going to deconstruct a building up for demolition for this project. So they were in effect going to unpack a building and then pile it up in its elemental parts in a playground in an empty school. And that was going to be the School of Reconstruction for 2 weeks. But in the end, we had to do the digital version. But that was just as successful because we got students from all over the world, because it was all via Teams, and we got tutors from all over the world as well. So we just got this great team of people working on amazing projects for a week. So we were able to do it in lots of different ways, and all that work means that we're able to employ in quite an informed way, a very informed way, these things on real projects. And so at the moment, as a practice, we're working on our own projects employing circular economy principles, but we're also advising design teams on larger projects. So we're doing resource maps for, you know, sites that former industrial sites that are going to have 800 homes plus all the other stuff. Actually saying that the stuff that's on site now, this is how you can reuse it in your new development. So you don't have to just, the first thing you do is you don't just sort of clear fell everything on site, scrape it up, throw it away. And then, by the way, buy the same similar stuff. and put it back, you know, which is what most people do at the moment.
Yes, there's a sort of a desire for cleanness, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, gosh.
They want a clean slate to start from, clean, fresh materials to go in. I understand that in some ways, because I know from, you know, personal building projects where we've used reclaimed materials, that the time it took me to process all these sort of odds and sods and, you know, bits that needed, you know, nails pulling out of and working out how to fit some dissimilar materials together. You know, it ended up costing, in a sort of time sense, much, much more. So I'm intrigued to know, does it happen at scale? Is that when it becomes cost effective?
Yeah, I think so. We need the digital and physical infrastructure to support it. So having done the waste house, it was, you know, that was a very challenging project, because what would happen is we'd find secondhand material, or people would give us secondhand material, and there'd be lots of it. And sometimes you didn't know what you were going to do with it. So that's one reason I agree with Rota. The people who are best placed to deal with the deconstruction of buildings are architects plus demolition people together. Demolition people know about the normal processes and networks for distribution. But architects know how buildings have been put together. Therefore, we can do the reverse engineering version of that and understand how to be put unpacked. But yeah, it's taken pathfinders like Rota and Superuse to sort of set up the digital and physical infrastructure for themselves to do it in a sort of micro way. To do it in a big way, we need platforms like Amazon, eBay, whatever. They're the material swapping platforms, or someone like that. I know large construction companies do it internally now, because it's cheaper to swap 200 sheets of plasterboard onto from one site to another rather than pay for it to be thrown away, which is what they're doing. But I also know that there was a white paper just before lockdown that was presented to the government, which was which presented a case for an online resource, a digital resource swapping platform. So I think there's a lot of people understanding the potential of it to be impactful. But you doing it on your own, or me doing it on your own, at the moment, you certainly don't save money doing it. You save resources. Mm-hmm. And you spend your money in a different way. But hopefully moving forward, when a lot more people understand what's required, and London's got a circular economy route map for the construction sector. Brighton's about to publish it, because I've been involved with it. And one of the first things they're saying is you need this thing called a remanufactory, which is an industrial building, well, basically a sheltered space that receives the stuff coming off these building sites, cleans it up, sorts it, markets it for redistribution. But that's a warehouse, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think because it's, in some cases, it's dealing with a bit of recycling as well as reuse, and it's new. These initial remanufactories will also have an R&D side to them.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm looking at doing. That's going to be our next project, is to work on a remanufactory for a local authority somewhere, because that's brilliant. That's what we need. We need the systems in place to support the methodologies.
Yeah. I think the Rota thing is fantastic. I've been perusing their website this morning, you know, looking at interesting door handles and coat hooks and, you know, tiles. I found some tiles. I was like, yes, I want those. But then obviously, you know, that's they're not my local material.
No, they're not.
And they won't even ship them to me. So is there something similar?
There are lots of emerging small companies having a go at it. And I think, you know, what we need is, it's an organization called MyROG that proffered this white paper. And we need it at a national scale. It needs to be, you could say that we do have it. We have Freegal at the moment, you know, and we do. Mm-hmm. We use Freegal to get materials. But something that's focused on the construction sector, we don't really have at the moment. There's lots of smaller organizations, you know, and I don't really want to name one without naming the other 17. There's lots of people having a go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm actually wearing my Bristol Wood Recycling Project t-shirt.
There you go. Nice.
So yes, the Wood Recycling Networks.
Well, that one needs a name check, because that's quite successful, isn't it?
So it was started down in Brighton, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So, but what I find interesting about that is it works. So I worked for Bristol Wood Recycling Project.
Okay.
And it works because of an army of volunteers to sort of pull nails out of bits of wood and, you know, to help collect. And I wonder how, like, while that is a wonderful thing, it's creating, you know, community and places for often sort of hard to reach groups to sort of, you know, be in community. That doesn't seem like it's a scalable thing. And that sort of volunteer aspect kind of creates the affordability of the end of the product, that the wood being sold back to the public. Yeah, how do you think it's sort of financially scalable? Or is it not?
The timber thing is difficult. There need to be incentives. I think once there are harsher incentives are thrown away, investing in the not thrown away option is going to be made easier. So yeah, that's where we go back to central government again. There need to be proper incentives to encourage this, because we're not paying the proper costs for the impact of throwing away at the moment, which, well, we are paying for it because we're having the bushfires and the floods everywhere and the landslides on a weekly basis because of that way of working. So we are actually we just need to recognise the true cost of these things, and then something like paying someone proper money to do a proper job of demaling timber is going to be the way forward. Mm-hmm. And you know, spending the right amount of time deconstructing the building instead of demolishing it is going to be absolutely attractive to do, because you'll get there'll be the incentives to do it. So that's with the existing stuff. With the stuff that we're going to design moving forward, there's no excuse for not bolting together your timber frame instead of nailing it. So, you know, there are ways of doing that should be outlawed because it's obviously not going to facilitate the deconstructing of a building at the end of its day. So we need to attack it at both ends all the way along this the line, as it were. But with the new stuff, we just got to make sure it's properly bolted together so it can be unbolted. So, you know, I've even said, and it might sound a bit unhelpful, but I'd rather a slightly leaky building from an airtightness point of view, if at the end of its life it's going to be easy to or realistic to deconstruct it. Whereas at the moment, I know from speaking to Rota, one of their biggest problems, by the way, one of the biggest problem is asbestos. So, you know, they get that taken out of a building first before they go anywhere near it. But then that's gone. The next biggest problem is the expanded foam around window openings and sticking things together, which shouldn't be stuck together just to achieve airtightness.
Yeah. I wondered if you could talk briefly about the tower block in Paris.
Oh, the lovely tower block by Lacaterne and Vassal. Yeah, that's... Mm. I love talking about that. One reason is because Lacaterne and Vassal, who won the Pritzker Prize this year, which is the biggest prize in international architecture, their strap line, as it were, is never demolish, never replace. And with that in mind, they quite famously understood that there was a residential tower block in Paris that was due for demolition because it was seen to be at the end of its life. And they made a representation to the mayor of Paris to say, we can give you your new tower block for two-thirds of the price that you're expecting to pay for it. And believe it or not, a decade went past before the then new mayor approached them and said, could you say that again? And this time we're taking notes, as it were. And they hadn't demolished the tower. They hadn't done the project. So Lacaterne and Vassal ended up doing it. Now, the way they could save a third of the price was because, of course, they didn't demolish it. All they did was to take off one panel at a time, the external concrete panels for the facades, the facade of the building. And they were able to do it with the inhabitants still occupying the tower. So one of the sort of not often considered negative consequences of demolition is that you disperse the community that lived in that building or those buildings. They never get back together again. They all go in different directions and you've broken up that community. And so to be able to sort of do a major refurbishment on the building without breaking up the community is one great big plus. Mm. So what was amazing is that they took the concrete facade off the building one panel at a time. And so it took one panel off, which was for one flat. I remember this thing's 30 stories high. It's really tall. And took the panel off and then bolted on this sort of glass box with a solid balcony. So it's like this enclosed balcony with an extra balcony on it. And the first layer of it next to the apartment, which had just lost its concrete facade, was full height, full width of the flat, sliding double glazed panels. And then this sort of extension of floor, and then another layer of these sliding panels, and then an external balcony. Now, the balcony is great because it's nice to be out on a balcony, but it's actually shading the glazing below it. So if you imagine these bolt-on enclosed glazed balconies, if you just clad the whole tower in those without the overhanging balcony, you just got a greenhouse and it would overheat. Yeah. So it's really important to have this extra bit of solid external balcony giving you solar shade. But what you also got with the sliding glaze partitions is you've got blinds on the inside to stop excessive glare in the winter when you've got low-lying sun coming in. But these enclosed glazed balconies, they actually created what we call an environmental buffer zone. They're unheated, but because of the air in them, because the air in the winter was warming up because of solar gain and what have you, it created this insulated coat for the tower. So the other thing it did is they went from small windows in these concrete panels to full width, full height, sliding glazing, they got lots of natural light during the day, which could be controlled with the internal blinds, two layers of internal blinds, both sets of sliding doors had blinds. But also natural ventilation was increased. So the healthy interior was something they benefit from with these new bolt-on balconies. Before they were having to turn their lights on in the flat during the day because the windows were so small. So the net result is they've got this sort of unheated but insulating coat that keeps them warm in the winter and cool in the summer. They've got vastly improved ventilation, so the air quality is good, and vastly improved natural light. And therefore, their energy bills plummeted. So it costs 40% less to heat and light these flats. And they got an extension to the flat. And it cost only two-thirds the price that the city had put aside for their new apartments. They look like... And it looks like a new block of flats, but it's actually the old one, just with a new coat. And the tenants are the same people, which in this case, it was sheltered accommodation for older people. So it's just win-win-win. And Lacaten & Vassal, who are the amazing practice who did this, and they've done it again and again, they've done a much larger scheme in Marseille doing a similar thing. I interviewed them for my book, and Anne Lacaten said, please don't call us environmentally friendly green architects or whatever. What we are is we're just coming up with a sort of practical best design solution. And that's what we need to address the climate emergency, is to employ really good design. And once you've got your constraints sorted out and your priorities, i.e. the reduction in the consumption of resources, then over to you, designers and architects, show us what you're going to do. I mean, the first project I ever heard about from Lacaten & Vassal was they were famous because they, in effect, turned down a commission to redesign an urban square in a town in Paris. It's not a town in Paris, a town in France. And what they did is they were commissioned to redesign this urban square, and they did the right sort of site analysis, looking at how it was being used and how it could be used better, and why was it not popular and how could it become popular? And they sent their results to the client, and they basically said, you don't have to do anything apart from repair the benches more often and clear up the dog poo more often. And then people will love it. It works really well apart from that. So we were all like jaws on the floor, because that's turning down a job. They were going to get tens of thousands of euros of fee. And they did their first bit of work and said, we don't need to do anything here. The guts to say nothing needs to be done apart from, well, maybe nothing or a bit, is what it takes. It's being authentic with your research and having a clear response. And, we as humankind have got to respond to the climate and ecological emergency and do that in an authentic way. And with that in mind, the rest should sort of fall into place. And one thing I always say is that we do have the collective knowledge of what to do. We know what to do collectively. Some people, we don't know everything, so we've just got to but you get a lot more used to open source research, and a lot more used to sharing our knowledge and learning from other people, listening and understanding. Because you get the great thing about the LETI Climate Emergency Design Guide was those 1,000 people that took part in the project in the first place. They were a cross sector from, you know, interior architects, environmental engineers, clients, contractors, all with their separate knowledges coming together, coming up with this consensus for a whole life carbon descent plan.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thank you so much to Duncan Baker Brown. That was so densely packed with information. There is a whole big list of links in the show notes. So do make sure you click through to those and get really into that library of information. Before I go, I just wanted to say, if you are one of the 300 or so that listen to this on Apple Podcasts in its very first week, then please, if you get a second, head to the Building Sustainability Apple page and leave a review. Leave a nice 5-star rating. Yeah, why not? That really does do a huge amount for getting the podcast noticed. That would be swell. And general sort of liking and sharing and telling your friends. You know the score. Okay, that's it. Thank you, everyone. I look forward to being back with you all soon. Until next time, bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.